It's time for Radio Freethinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's wine is about Charlie Hebdo, the now famous magazine, made so by the more infamous shooting that occurred there a little over 2 weeks ago. There's a lot to weigh in on this issue, and I wanted to wait until things settled down and we know more about what had happened and what the repercussions were of this horrific event, before we here at Radio Free Thinker sort of dipped our toe and set our 2 cents worth. First, in a tactic I hope the CBC or Maclean's does not follow, it was, at least in the short term and in the financial sense, one of the best things that could have happened to Charlie Hebdo. Unlike many others, the magazine is not unknown to us here at Radio Free Thinker. We discuss the mag as part of a broader discussion on blasphemy laws and free speech. The magazine, like so many other members of the printed press, was on financial hard times. It had dwindling circulation of about 30,000. In fact, many suspect the reason the magazine was so provocative was its attempt to try and keep its readership. Irrespective of why, the magazine received a great windfall, at a horrible price I might add, in solidarity sales. Last I checked, the post-shooting edition sold in excess of 5 million copies. I would like to point out the cover. Not having a copy myself, I can't speak for its internal contents, but the cover was, I think, pretty classy. They could have, and I don't think anyone would have condemned them for it, if they had been, you know, much more angrier and vengeful and vitriolic. But instead, the cover had Muhammad with a tear in his eye, holding the iconic sign, Je suis Charlie, I am Charlie, with a caption saying, all is forgiven. Now, I have often condemned the rush to call any attack by brown people an act of terrorism while we reserve lone wolf or nut job for those of the paler skin variety. Well, as things turned out, and most importantly a video released by Al-Qaeda of Yemen, this was most definitely your classic kind of terrorism. That said, why France? Why Charlie? Well, the only theme that has arisen out of the massacre is the meme that in France, free speech is paramount. It is an absolute right. The fact these Muslim terrorists took offense and used violence to stop Charlie's free speech just proved how un-French they truly were. The commentary that the reason the Solidarity March in Paris was the largest in French history was because the French hold liberty, in this case the liberty to print offensive cartoons, as fundamental to French identity. That this was just not an attack on a magazine publisher, but the very idea of what it is to be French. Now, if you've looked at the cartoons this magazine published, you might agree that they're not only offensive, but they are actively attempting to push the boundaries of offense. Although, as I already mentioned, some claim it has become more radical in its drawings in a vain attempt to improve readership. From what I've learned, they've been doing this for a very, very long time, that this is kind of their whole history of lampooning French society. And although the focus, because of this attack, has been on the way Charlie has gone out of its way to offend Muslims, it's also true they've gone out of their way to offend Catholics, politicians, celebrities, everyone. And yes, they even had Hitler on the cover. Now, maybe they focused a little more on Muslims, and I can't confirm this, but considering they were firebombed for publishing an edition with, quote, Muhammad as editor, saying the joke, 1,000 lashes of the whip if you don't die from laughter, well, you know, maybe they did have a certain special place for Islam. So it would seem that Charlie Hebdo, well, as the Pope just recently said, and a tad out of character for him, he said, if you insult my mother, I will punch you. So he seems to think Charlie was sort of asking for it. This then begs the question, why was it a Muslim attack? As I mentioned, Charlie Hebdo was insulting to pretty much everyone, including the far right wing, the quasi-neo-Nazi Front National Party of France. They even had a rather quizzical cover showing the leader of that party shaving an imaginary Hitler into the pubic hair area. Classy, no? And we're talking neo-Nazis. These are really violent people. One would think there are a number of groups that would attack Charlie Hebdo, and yet, no. One could jump to the conclusion Islam is a more violent religion, but by and large, we debunked that a couple of episodes ago right here on Radio Free Thinker. And why France and not England? To be honest, I would have thought an attack like this would have occurred in Germany, where currently there are sort of a war of rallies going on between anti-immigrant racists and those who oppose such groups as PEGDA. And PEGDA stands for Patriotic Europeans Against the Islamification of the West. You see, one of the confounding factors, and one I think more acute in France than anywhere else in Europe, is the isolation of migrant workers. Notice I said migrant and not immigrant. France, and to be fair, most of Europe, allows and to varying degrees encourages migrants to come and work in the jobs that locals don't want to do, seasonal jobs, what have you. This happens in Canada, but the biggest difference is when we call on migrant workers, we do so with the assumption that they will become citizens. Well, I guess our foreign worker program of late has kind of made this a dubious claim, but we'll talk about that in a different show. This is not the case in Europe. We can have workers living there for decades and not being allowed to become citizens. Where you have generations of families not being citizens of the nation they were born in. You can get this underclass of people who can at any time, with as little as 24 hours notice, be evicted from the country they may have called home since their birth. This leads to a ghettoization, where migrant workers are, through overt or institutional discrimination, discouraged from integrating into regular French society. And I just don't mean that you get neighborhoods where you have a predominantly Iranian or Italian families. No, because even with these, you get a social mixing in the workplace, cultural activities. Not so much in Europe, especially in France. So you get in France the ironic term, second-generation immigrant. These are people who are born in France, but are not part of French society, are not French citizens, who are excluded on the one hand from France and forced to embrace their sort of foreign identity for lack of any other. There's also another weird irony. Countries like France tend to have a decent social welfare. And by decent, I mean you can live on, as in barely, on it alone, unlike many other nations. But this has led to a situation where you have pockets of immigrants where unemployment rates can be as high as 40%. So you have an impoverished, alienated, segregated population just ripe for radicalizers to manipulate into doing their evil deeds. In this case, shoot up a magazine publisher. And don't get me wrong, I'm not referring to the now famous Fox no-go zones. These are not no-go zones. These are not some weird things. It's just, think of ghettos. You may have noted that I mentioned institutional discrimination. And that has caused the call for free speech, liberty before all else, no one is above offense, to be a tad farcical. And yes, it is possible to have a nation steeped in free speech and still be racist. Look south of the border. And yet, you might get shot for performing an abortion, but not even these God-hate-fags Westboro Baptists were ever attacked, at least not that I've ever heard of. No, the farce arose a week after the massacre when the French government went on a crackdown on Muslims. I want to say jihadists, potential terrorists, violent gangs, and maybe they did arrest some of those, but of the at least 54 arrests of late, one of them, a Mbawa, a person who, like Charlie Hebdo, was an extremely offensive, quote, comedian, well, he was arrested for posting on social media in response to the Je suis Charlie, a Je suis, and the name of one of the killers, on the grounds that it was hate speech. The hypocrisy is so thick, you could just throw up. Another man was convicted for saying, I am proud to be Muslim, I do not like Charlie, they were right to do what they did. Prosecutions of hate speech are not in themselves hypocritical. I have on Radio Free Thinker discussed the value of anti-hate speech laws. But I did not wrap myself up in the flag of absolute free speech rights trumping being offended by that speech. So the people of France, by being offended with a segment of their population, well, at least a few individuals, sympathizers with the terrorist, to arrest them for expressing their views actually, in a way, vindicates the actions of those terrorists by asserting some things are so offensive they should not be tolerated. And don't get me wrong, I am sure some of the arrested may have gone far beyond just sympathizing and may have actually called for violent actions. That is a very gray and fine line. That would, to me, be a bridge too far, and not one even Charlie Hebdo crossed. Oh yeah, one more closing comment. For those of you who may have seen the vids or the pics of the Solidarity March, may have noticed a number of prominent political figures. A number of these were offensive to sensible people by the sheer chutzpah of them showing up. For example, the ambassador of Saudi Arabia. Arabia, where a blogger is beginning to serve a sentence of 1,000 lashes for criticizing Islam. Then there was the Egyptian foreign minister, on the same week that saw Canada's own John Baird plead the case for a Canadian journalist who was convicted for reporting, doing their job, in what everyone has recognized has been a completely farcical trial. And of course you have Israel's Netanyahu, whose nation has a history of targeting journalists during military exercises. Also present was Palestinian leader Abbas, King Abdullah of Jordan, Russian foreign minister, president of Gabon, Bahrain foreign minister, and others. All of these people who far from supporting free speech, but are some of the biggest suppressors of said free speech in their home country. It was just disgusting. Well, we'll return after this break.
The UBC Students Association presents the Colloquium, a conference featuring presentations by English students and faculty members. It will take place on January 31st in Irving K. Barber. Feature presentations by Catherine Serluck, Sean Eckert, and Peter Mahone. Did we mention there will be free food? Register now at www.ubcenglish.com.
And we're back. So the evidence is rolling in, and it seems that 2014 will be the hottest year on record. And still, people like our own dear leader, Stephen Harper, does nothing. Never forget 2015. Well, anyhow, to start the new year, I thought I would bring you some web wisdom about how climate change works, what evidence we have for it, why we know we are the primary cause, and why it's hard to convince others it's reality and the actions needed. So let's listen in.
Let's not beat around the rapidly melting iceberg here. Climate change is happening, and we are causing it. The evidence is overwhelming. Scientists usually reserve this level of agreement for claims like Earth is a planet or air is real. Yet here we are. The climate change ship has now left the dock, yet lots of people on shore are still debating whether boats can actually float. But maybe you're a person who trusts and accepts what climate scientists are telling us. It's just, sometimes it's hard to explain why. I mean, we've all been there. I mean, I care about the environment. I figure with the polar bears and everything, we might as well try electric cars. What do we have to lose? And then they go caps lock serious, saying they have proof that climate change is a hoax perpetuated by scientists paid off by the polar bear lobby as part of a plan to install Al Gore as Supreme World Polar Bear Emperor. Wake up, sheeple! To keep that from happening, we put together this handy reference. The sun is the source of warmth on Earth, so thanks for that, sun. Ice and clouds reflect some of its light away, but the rest is absorbed by land and water and re-emitted as heat. Some of that heat escapes to space, and some is held in by the atmospheric greenhouse effect. The insulating effect of Earth's greenhouse gases are the reason that life exists as we know it, but human activities have increased the concentration of one of them, carbon dioxide, 40% since the Industrial Revolution. We know the sun's output has varied during history, but since the 1970s, the period when global temperatures increased the fastest, temperature and solar activity have moved in opposite directions. If the sun was to blame, it would cook the upper and lower layers of the atmosphere together. Instead, we only see warming in the lower layers, the same place that human greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide are piling up. Since 1870, with fossil fuels, cement production, and land use combined, humans have put about 2,000 gigatons of CO2 into the atmosphere. That's 2 million tons, and about 40% has stayed there. Studying gases trapped in ice cores has let us see what Earth's atmosphere was like in the past. At more than 400 parts per million, today's carbon dioxide levels are the highest they've been for almost a million years. That's before humans even existed. Totally uncharted territory for us. More carbon dioxide in the atmosphere means average temperatures across the globe are increasing, and fast. Right now, Earth is warming about 10 times faster than at the end of an ice age. Okay, so CO2 is increasing. How do we know it's our fault? The best evidence comes from looking at what isotopes, or different kinds of carbon, are in the atmosphere. Fossil fuels come mainly from old plants. Plants prefer to use the lighter isotope carbon-12 over the heavier carbon-13, so they contain a higher ratio of 12 to 13 than the atmosphere does. When more fossil fuels get burned, the percentage of carbon-12 in the atmosphere should go up, and that's exactly what we see. And it's not because of volcanic activity. Volcanoes only emit about 1% as much CO2 as we do. Normally, that CO2 is balanced in exchange between the atmosphere, plants, and animals. But eliminating carbon sinks has released centuries worth in just a few years. Other greenhouse gases are also increasing, like methane from farm animals and natural gas processing, or nitrous oxide from fertilizers. If we run simulations just using natural causes of climate change, they predict no change or even cooling in the 20th century, and that is not what's happening. It's still going to get cold in some places, but in the 2000s, there were twice as many record highs as record lows. And each of the past three decades has been warmer than any other decade since we started measuring in 1850. Since 1900, actual temperatures around the world have increased almost a full degree, and most of that has happened since the 1970s. Looking at data from tree rings and ice cores, the past 30 years is probably the warmest in eight centuries. Of course, not every place on Earth warms equally. Oceans cover more than 70% of Earth, and they absorb more than 90% of the heat added to the planet. Naturally, that's where we see the most extreme changes. Around the world, oceans are rising a tenth of an inch per year, and they're up 8 inches since 1901. This is because water expands as it warms. And when ice sheets and glaciers melt in Greenland and Antarctica, water that's normally on frozen land gets put in the ocean. The oceans are Earth's largest carbon sink. As more CO2 enters the atmosphere, more of it dissolves in the ocean, which makes the water more acidic. This doesn't mean the oceans will be made of acid, but animals with calcium shells are super sensitive to pH. We're on course for the oceans to hit pH 7.8 in 100 years, which could wipe out one-third of species in the ocean. We also know that levels of summer sea ice in the Arctic have decreased 40% since 1978. They might be the lowest levels in 1,400 years. That white sea ice usually reflects the sun's energy back into the atmosphere, but the dark ocean is soaking it up like a black shirt on a sunny day, which feeds the cycle forward. If CO2 emissions continue on their current trends, Earth is on course to be 2.5 to 5 degrees warmer. The oceans could be up to a meter higher by the end of this century. Is that a big deal? Yeah, it's the biggest deal. This is by far the greatest issue facing our species. The last time the Earth averaged a few degrees colder, most of North America was covered in a mile-thick sheet of ice. That many degrees warmer? We're gonna have a bad time. So now you're armed with the facts, why we know climate change is happening, and why we're causing it. Please, share this information with the people you know, and then... We've filled libraries with reports and graphs and books about climate change. More facts than you can shake a hockey stick at. Yet still, 4 out of 10 Americans aren't convinced. And consider this, among the majority who do accept the science of climate change, folks don't seem to be doing much about it. Today we're going to look at a few of the reasons why facts don't always work, how our brain fights with itself to keep us from responding to threats, and the science of why some people don't believe in climate science. Kurt Vonnegut once said, "I was taught that the human brain was the crowning glory of evolution so far, but I think it's a very poor scheme for survival." The problem is, we're human. Psychologist John Tooby says, "Our modern skulls house a Stone Age mind. We've come a long way since our cave-dwelling days, but what Tooby means is we're dealing with the threats of today using tools from our brain's evolutionary past. The issues that really grab our attention involve pain. According to psychologist Daniel Gilbert, we respond more strongly to threats that are personal, that represent abrupt changes in our environment, that are immoral or indecent, and that are affecting us now. Climate change is a gradual, impersonal thing that always seems to live in the future. But if climate change threatened these puppies, wouldn't you pay more attention? Our one brain is really two, one rational and one emotional. The rider looks like they're in control, but the elephant really has the last say. Lots of the time, our emotional brain elephant isn't even listening. Let's say the writer loved that article about how climate change is threatening banana crops, but the elephant isn't motivated to act until the bananas are gone. According to psychologist Daniel Kahneman, when we're faced with uncertain threats about things we might lose in the distant future, our brains will invent all kinds of excuses not to act on them today. I mean, look at the way we talk about climate change. It always seems to happen in the future tense.
Caretakers of the future, what the future holds. Sheltering future generations, stand up for our future.
A poll by Yale University shows 65% of people think climate change will harm future generations, and just 38% say it will harm them personally. This is what Kahneman calls our optimism bias, assuming that we face lower risks than others do. Car accidents won't happen to us, or the next big hurricane surely won't hit here, because bad things only happen to other people. I can point to extreme storms like Hurricane Sandy or Typhoon Haiyan as obvious effects of climate change, but someone else might point to them as proof that the climate is random. We have a tendency to cherry-pick evidence that supports our existing beliefs. It doesn't help that many climate change threats are becoming so familiar that they're just normal.
A new United Nations report raised the threat of climate change to a whole new level.
Severe, pervasive, and irreversible.
Longer, hotter, drier droughts, and it will only get worse.
The world is ill-prepared for what is to come.
Without action, there could be irreversible damage.
The fundamental systems that support human civilization are at risk.
Hurricanes and wildfires are always on the news. September 2014 was the 355th month in a row of higher than average temperatures. It's like a broken record, broken record, broken record. People also doubt climate change because they're uncertain about uncertainty. When scientists talk about uncertainties, all the known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns, many people think they're not confident in their findings when the opposite is true. Less than 1 in 4 Americans think that there's a scientific consensus about climate change, yet 97% of scientists are in agreement.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
What's weird is we don't apply this uncertainty about uncertainty to other issues. A 1% chance of a terrorist attack, and we're sounding all the alarms.
Instead of drifting along toward tragedy, we will set a course toward safety.
But nearly certain global disruption from climate change...
There is not agreement around the fact of exactly what is causing this.
The climate is always changing between pauses, and that we are not capable with our limited knowledge of predicting which way it will go next.
8 inches of snow in the East Coast. I've got an explanation. That's not climate change. It's called winter.
Thanks to today's hyperbole-infused media, we're almost numb or indifferent to anything that isn't about to literally kill us. Why aren't more people worried? Patricia Linville and Gregory Fisher argue that we have a finite pool of worry, and climate change isn't allowed in the water. We view and make sense of our world through frames, not just so we can focus better on what's inside, but also to decide what we can ignore. For some people, your frame is built based on your political party. For others, it's carved out of your religious beliefs or your economic philosophy. Viewing the world through the same frame as your social in-group, whatever that might be, is important to remaining part of that in-group. Basically, we're all puppets controlled by the strings of social conformity. That's not a choice, it's just who we are. From the time we're kids, we read social cues from people around us, like how to talk or not burping in public. Our survival used to literally depend on being part of a social group, so if you're part of some social group that doesn't believe in climate change, you have two risks to weigh. Climate change and all of its uncertainties were the very personal risk of becoming an outsider. Sociologist Stanley Cohen writes that climate change denial isn't not knowing or refusing to know. It's about choosing not to notice or talk about it so that we don't rock the in-group boat. Climate change is almost the perfect problem. We've got to do something about it, but every one of its attributes goes against our psychology. It's like that black cloud from Lost. It has no identity, no home, no single cause, and no single solution. It's about more than science. It involves economics, morals, human rights, ideology, technology. It's really hard. In another video, we laid out the facts about why man-made climate change is real. And here we talked about the many reasons why facts don't always work. But I haven't answered the most important question. How do we get people to act? The truth is, I don't know. Action is the destination, but I'm not sure about the path we should take to get there. I mean, is anyone?
Science Week 2015 is a week-long celebration aimed at solidifying and fostering a sense of community and faculty pride. Free events will take place from January 19th to 23rd, providing students an opportunity to connect. Find more information on Facebook by searching for Science Week 2015.
And we're back. Next, we have Stephen Fry on who's his favorite philosopher and the importance of disbelief. What was that you were saying there, Stephen?
Philosophy is an odd thing. When we use the word in everyday speech, you sometimes hear it hilariously. They say, oh, It's never good to be late. That's my philosophy. You think that's a generous ascription of that rather dull precept to call it a philosophy. But it's odd how philosophers, generally speaking, at least the ones I've read or the ones I value, don't have, in that sense, a philosophy. There is no particular Socratic or Nietzschean or Kantian way to live your life. They don't offer ethical codes and standards by which to live your life. They don't offer a philosophy to follow. They just simply raise an enormous number of questions, mostly. So in the sense that you put the question, is there a philosopher that's important to me? Well, I loved really the sort of Bertrand Russell grand sort of tour of philosophy, the history of philosophy from the pre-Socratics, as they're called, Zeno and so on, through to Socrates and Plato and then Aristotle. I never quite liked Aristotle. I think that's partly, although he was obviously a genius and a brilliant, and he invented logic, so what's not to like? I think it was his influence on the medieval mind was probably rather pernicious and unfortunate and all those categories and things. But when it opened up with, I suppose, Spinoza but then Kant really in the Enlightenment era. Oh, and actually Locke, I did like Locke. He was a fine philosopher. But they don't, I mean, what's so great about them is that they just, you know, they're quite scary when you think of the word philosopher, and especially if it's logic and symbolic logic, and you get onto Hegelian philosophy. It's incredibly difficult to read, I find, and you follow for about, oh, it's like trying to grab a salmon, you know? The harder you clutch at it, the more it slips out of your hand, and whoa, it's gone, and you chase it again, and oh, what was that? And you feel very stupid. But I think the beauty of questioning and simplicity that you get from Kant in particular, I think, is just amazing, because it's like they say of simple mathematical laws, you know, that make fractals, the tiniest little elegant observation about or question about something just spins out these immensely complex things that make you rethink everything. So, yes, I think philosophy is a really important dimension, but I think in our age we tend to be rather sloppy about it. We either think Buddhism is philosophy, which, you know, or some sort of Eastern thing about being nice and spiritual, and that'll do. Which is fine. I mean, you know, obviously I believe in kindness and niceness and lots of spiritual things, but the real intellectual rigor and quest of logic is something that I'm afraid takes incredibly hard work. And we live in an age in which hard work is, if not actively deprecated or denigrated, it is run away from or ignored. It's sort of people frown at you and say, well, that's a bit dull and stupid. Why can't we just short-circuit it and talk about, like, spirit? Well, yeah, you can say spirit, but if you think that's philosophy, and if you think that's good enough, the most important philosophy, I think, is that even if it isn't true, you must absolutely assume there is no afterlife. You cannot for one second, I think, abrogate the responsibility of believing that this is it. Because if you think you're going to have an eternity in which you can talk to Mozart and Schopenhauer on a cloud and learn stuff and, you know, really get to grips with knowledge and understanding, and so you won't bother now, I think it's a terrible mistake. It may be that there is an afterlife and I'll look incredibly stupid, but at least I will have had a crammed pre-afterlife, a crammed life. So to me, the most important thing is, you know, as Kipling put it, you know, to fill every 60 seconds with, no, what is it? To fill every unforgiving minute with 60 seconds worth of distance run, you know, absolutely. So that's all I'm saying, I suppose, is that there's no point wasting time being lazy. Though, of course, indolence in a divine way, axidy, has its advantages. Oh, shut up, Steve. Okay, next one. It's interesting. Atheism comes in for rather a bad press, and I suppose I'd rather describe myself as a humanist. I don't believe in God. I don't believe there is a God. If I were to believe in a God, I would believe in gods. I think monotheism is the really ghastly thing. That is the absolutely staggering, to me, misapprehension. I can perfectly see why anybody might imagine that each thing that grows, each phenomenon that accompanies us on our journey through life, the sky, the mountains, spirits of nature, I can imagine why man would wish to endow them with an inner something, an inner animus that they would call the god of that thing. I can see that. It's a beautiful and charming way of looking at it, and I can understand the Greek idea that there are these, you know, these principles of lightning or of war or of wisdom, and that to embody them, to personify them into Athena or Ares or whichever god you want, makes enormous sense. But to say that there is one only God who made it all and who is, you know, that is just, what, why, who said, where, come on. And I love how when people watch, I don't know, a David Attenborough or a Discovery Planet type thing, you know, where you see the absolute phenomenal majesty and complexity and bewildering beauty of nature, and you stare at it, and then somebody next to you goes, and how can you say there's no God? Look at that. And then 5 minutes later, you're looking at the life cycle of a parasitic worm whose job is to bury itself in the eyeball of a little lamb and eat the eyeball from inside while the lamb dies in horrible agony. And then you turn to them and say, yeah, where is your God now? You know? I mean, you can't just say there's a God because the world is beautiful. You have to account for bone cancer in children. You have to account for the fact that almost all animals in the wild live under stress with not enough to eat and will die violent and bloody deaths. There is not any way that you can just choose the nice bits and say that means there is a God and ignore the true fact of what nature is. The wonder of nature must be taken in its totality, and it is a wonderful thing. It is absolutely marvelous. And the idea that an atheist or a humanist, if you want to put it that way, doesn't marvel and wonder at reality, at the way things are, is nonsensical. The point is, we wonder all the way. We don't just stop and say, that which I cannot understand I will call God, which is what mankind has done historically. That's to say, God was absolutely everything 1,000 or 2,000 years ago because we understood almost nothing about the natural world. So it could all be God. And then as we understood more, God receded and receded and receded. So suddenly now he's barely anywhere. He's just in those things we don't understand, which are important. But I think it just is such an insult to humanity. And the Greeks got it right. The Greeks understood perfectly that if there were divine beings, they are capricious, unkind, malicious mostly, temperamental, envious, and mostly deeply unpleasant. Because that you can say, well, yes, all right, if there's going to be God or gods, then you have to admit that they're at the very least capricious. They're certainly not consistent. They're certainly not all-loving. I mean, really, it's just not good enough, is it? You know, if we empower ourselves with responsibility over our actions, responsibility over our destinies, and responsibility for directing and maintaining and creating our own ethical and moral frameworks, which is the most important thing, really, isn't it? Because perhaps the greatest insult to humanism is this idea that mankind needs a God in order to have a moral framework. There's a very clear way of demonstrating logically how absurd that is, because the warrant for that logical framework, for that moral framework that comes from God, is always tested against man's own morals. It's a complicated argument, but I mean, that's, you know, it's the standard one, which is pretty unanswerable. But the idea that we don't know right from wrong, but we have to take it from words put down in a book 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,000 years ago and dictated to rather hot-headed, neurotic desert tribes, is just insulting. I mean, it's just no. I mean, if there were a God, he would want us to be better spirited than to take his word for everything. You know, wouldn't he? If he gave us free will, would he really want us to say, no, I have to abide by everything that's written in this book? All the laws of circumcision and of eating and what to do with menstruating women, I'm going to obey those written down there. I won't think for myself because that's not required of me. Come on. It's just not good enough. And you know, I have no quarrel with individuals who are devout and who have faith. I don't want to mock them. I really don't. But damned if I'm going to be told by them what to do with my body, or damned if I'm going to have the extraordinary battles won by enlightenment over the past 400 years, to have those battles abnegated by a new Dark Ages. The battle lines must be drawn. Music in its time, but I mean that's a function of history. You know, the fact is that the composers always write for power. Because they're all power and money, and it so happened that in the period when polyphony all the way through to the classical and early Romantic era, all the power and the money was with the church. So some great masses and some great choral music and some great oratorios were written from obviously the Baroque age being the sort of pinnacle of that, but all the way through to the Mozart's final works and his Requiem and Beethoven's Missa Solemnis and Mendelssohn and so on. There have been some marvellous religious works, and in painting similarly. But that's because these were princes. They were princes of the church. They were prince archbishops who employed Mozart. These were not spiritual beings who inculcated these composers with the sense of the divine that makes the music divine. The glory of Verdi's Requiem or Mozart's Requiem or Bach's pieces is that they are fantastically, incredibly human. And like all great human things, they reach for the infinite. They reach for beauty. A religious person would call that the divine. You could call it the numinous. You could call it anything else. But certainly is... That religion's been good for that, and good for architecture, because it has required enormous buildings for the shepherding of people in order to do the services, and they spend a lot of money on it, and so they are rather glorious buildings. You've got to hand them that. Did they make the trains run on time? No, they didn't do that. That's about it, really. No, and there are some kind individual people. I mean, very kind people who give to the poor and look after the sick and so on. But it's not necessary and sufficient. As a justification for religion, because there are plenty of people who are not religious who are also kind to the sick and good to the poor and care about, you know, people's well-being. Yes, oh, very much so. I mean, Trevor Huddleston and Archbishop Tutu from South Africa are two good examples who were both genuine men of the church, or obviously Huddleston is dead, but Tutu's still alive, and who both fought a terrible injustice and used all the authority of their position amongst their believers, but very bravely spoke out, sometimes against the wishes of the church hierarchies. Some liberation theologists some of them mad communists, some of them just decent liberals who fought against the hideous doctrines of the Roman Catholic Church, for example. And there are individual voices who are raised in conscience against the bureaucracy and the dogma and the doctrine of the churches. And, you know, certainly, of course, individuals Bonhoeffer, for example, in Germany, the Lutheran minister who spoke out against Hitler. There have been good and fine religious people. And the Dalai Lama seems rather charming. I don't know. It's terrible. I don't want to come over as some terrible anti-ecclesiastical figure. But
today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
Now, this is an election year, and as such, it's even more important to remember the quote, traditional parties, liberal conservatives, well, they've never been the people's party. They've always served the money class and the corporations. So as a treat, I thought I would play you the classic Mouse Land speech by Tommy Douglas, the man who brought Medicare to the nation, who was the first leader of the NDP, and was voted the greatest Canadian ever in 2004. Let's listen in.
It's a story of a place called Mouse Land. Mouse Land was a place where all the little mice lived and played, were born and died, and they lived much as you and I do. They even had a parliament. And every 4 years they had an election. They used to walk to the polls and cast their ballot. Some of them even got a ride to the polls. Got a ride for the next 4 years afterwards, too. Just like you and me. And every time on election day, all the little mice used to go to the ballot box and they used to elect a government. A government made up of big, fat, black cats. Now, if you think it's strange that mice should elect a government made up of cats, you just look at the history of Canada for the last 90 years, and maybe you'll see that they weren't any stupider than we are. Now, I'm not saying anything against the cats. They were nice fellows. They conducted the government with dignity. They passed good laws. That is, laws that were good for cats. But the laws that were good for cats weren't very good for mice. One of the laws said that mouse holes had to be big enough so a cat could get his paw in. Another law said that mice could only travel at certain speeds so that a cat could get his breakfast without too much physical effort. All the laws were good laws for cats, but all they were hard on the mice. And life was getting harder and harder. And when the mice couldn't put up with it anymore, they decided something had to be done about it. So they went en masse to the polls. They voted the black cat out. And they put in the white cat. The white cat had put up a terrific campaign. They said all that Mouseland needs is more vision. They said the trouble with Mouseland is those round mouse holes we've got. If you put us in, we'll establish square mouse holes. And they did. And the square mouse holes were twice as big as the round mouse holes. And now the cat could get both his paws in. And life was tougher than ever. And when they couldn't take that anymore, they voted the white cats out and put the black ones in again. And then they went back to the white cats and then to the black cats. They even tried half black cats and half white cats. And they called that coalition. They even got one government made up of cats with spots on them. They were cats that tried to make a noise like a mouse, but they ate like a cat. You see, my friends, the trouble wasn't with the color of the cat. The trouble was that they were cats. And because they were cats, they naturally looked after cats instead of mice. Presently, there came along one little mouse who had an idea. My friend, watch out for the little fellow with an idea. And he said to the other mice, look, fellas, why do we keep on electing a government made up of cats? Why don't we elect a government made up of mice? Oh, they said, he's a Bolshevik. Lock him up. So they put him in jail. But I want to remind you that you can lock up a mouse or a man, but you can't lock up an idea.
Well, that's about all the time we have this week. Yesterday was Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and considering the state of race relations in the U.S., I thought I would end the show with his famous I Have a Dream speech, just in case you missed it. So this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Freethinker. Remember to visit us online at RadioFreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 million suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation. Five score years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. And so we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse to believe that there are insufficient funds in the great vaults of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us upon demand the riches of freedom and the security of justice. We have also come to this hallowed spot to remind America of the fierce urgency of now. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real the promises of democracy. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation to the sunlit path of racial justice. Now is the time to lift our nation from the quicksands of racial injustice to the solid rock of brotherhood. Now is the time to make justice a reality for all of God's children. It would be fatal for the nation to overlook the urgency of the moment. This sweltering summer of the Negro's legitimate discontent will not pass until there is an invigorating autumn of freedom and equality. 1963 is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. There will be neither rest nor tranquility in America until the Negro is granted his citizenship rights. The whirlwinds of revolt will continue to shake the foundations of our nation until the bright day of justice emerges. But that is something that I must say to my people who stand on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrongful deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must forever conduct our struggle on the high plane of dignity and discipline. We must not allow our creative protests to degenerate into physical violence. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic heights of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militancy which has engulfed the Negro community must not lead us to a distrust of all white people. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is tied up with our destiny. And they have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. And as we walk, we must make the pledge that we shall always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our bodies, heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the cities. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs stating for whites only. We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote, and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied, and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities. Knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification, one day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, and every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope. This is the faith that I go back to the South with. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mountain of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. This will be the day. This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, "My country, 'tis of thee." Sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. From the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire, let freedom ring. From the mighty mountains of New York, let freedom ring. From the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania, let freedom ring. From the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado, let freedom ring. From the curvaceous slopes of California, but not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to CITR.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?